Hello, and welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast with your hosts, Joe Lavelle and Dr. Glenn Winkle. On today's episode number 107, we are talking with the one and the only Dr. Phil Maffetone. Dr. Phil is the creator of the Maximum Aerobic Function, or MAF, method of building extraordinary fat-burning fitness, which has been used by endurance athletes of all levels for the last 30 years. To my great surprise, I found out that Dr. Phil is at it again, ahead of the curve, this time in the use of music for athletic performance via improved recovery and for brain development. Dr. Phil has been reborn as a musician and songwriter, and he has recently published a book called E-Sharp that explains it all. I have been following Dr. Phil's advice on music for the last several weeks, and I can tell you he is so right. My recovery, stress management, simply the quality of my life has increased since following his advice. So listen in to hear Dr. Phil's tips on using music, as well as a refresher on his important contributions for developing the cardiovascular system to build a strong foundation for health and resilience, especially as we age. In case you were wondering, the music you hear in the background right now is called Twice in One Lifetime, written and performed by Dr. Phil himself. If you would like to hear the entire song, I've included the entire recording at the end of this episode. I think you'll like it. All right, let's talk to Dr. Phil Maffetone about using music for the betterment of our brains and our bodies. Dr. Phil Maffetone, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to be here. This is my first recording with you, and I'm honored.
Well, thank you. I hope not the last one. I got to tell you, I'm so pleased to have you on our podcast. Thank you for accepting our invitation. The main topic for today is music, which is going to be a shock to people who know your name. I think it'll be a shock. It was a shock to me, which is a newer aspect of your amazing career, a career that I think can be summarized as helping athletes to be faster by being healthier. Is that a fair way of putting it?
That's a good way to put it. I learned early in my career, actually as a student, that I wanted to work with people. I wanted to be in the human performance arena, which is sort of something I came up with because there was nothing I found where I could say, oh, here's a good career, human performance. And I ended up being in sports among other audiences. And the foundation was always, I want to help them perform better without sacrificing their health. Huh? That's a strategy that that I've implemented. And it's also an unfortunate strategy that many people have done the opposite with. Many people were willing to sacrifice their health, whether a corporate executive or a teacher or student or athlete, as is often the case.
Yeah. It sounds like an approach, your approach, is a sustainable one. So for wise athletes who are not just looking to be stronger, but they want to be athletes for a long time, long into life, an approach that helps them to be healthy and strong sounds like a smart way to go.
It is, and I like the name Wise Athletes because it's really, I've always said to athletes that the most important part of your body is your brain. And of course, that confuses them. I have a way of saying things that confuse people. You know, they think, my brain? What? And of course, it's the brain that makes the body move. Yeah. And so what happens in the brain happens in the body. And so you want to trace what the body's doing or not doing back to what the brain is supposed to be doing in terms of performing better, more efficiently, whatever.
Sure.
And so the brain is where it all begins.
Well, and it's hard to have a healthy brain if you don't have a healthy body.
It goes back and forth. It's all one, really. We have a, you know, in our society, we have a way of trying to put things in little boxes. Oh, your brain is here. Your body is here. Oh, you're an athlete, so you're here with the muscle box. And muscles don't do anything by themselves. They just sit there. They wait for the brain to tell them to move, and not just to move, but exactly how to move, when to contract, when to relax. And so what better way to be a better athlete than having a better brain?
Right. Okay. Before we get into the music side of our story here, I think we should start
for the audience's sake here, with you giving us kind of a high-level overview of the math method. Why did you develop it? Why did you see a need for it? And help us understand why it works.
I didn't sit down and think, what am I going to, let's see, what can I put together here? What could I, you know, what technique can I do? It just became part of me, really going back to early on as an undergraduate student. It was being holistic, the philosophy of the human body in motion, the big picture, avoiding the trendy stuff that society throws out at us, that the magazines tell us we should do, and so on and so forth. One of the things I realized was that, especially for athletes, but really for everybody, is that we have all kinds of different systems in the body that work together. And one of the systems that was sort of left out, left behind, is the aerobic system. And it was an important system and a terrible one to leave behind because it's one of the most important systems for humans. Humans evolved on the aerobic system from the beginning. We walked a lot. We ran slow a lot. We were able to do it all day long.
Yeah.
And so in studying the aerobic system, I saw that the slow twitch muscle fibers were part of that system, and that was important for everybody. And those muscle fibers burned a lot of fat for energy. Nobody ever talked about fat burning. Not very many people in the scientific literature. It was not uncommon if you looked for it. Everything was sugar-based, glucose-based. The aerobic muscle fibers also were the slow twitch, but they were muscle fibers that could work all day long. So they would support our body. They would hold us up. They would support our joints, and they would support other muscles. So this was like the perfect system to focus on for being both healthy and fit. And I was in endurance sports quite a bit, with running and cycling and swimming, triathlons and so forth. But I also worked with a lot of other people who didn't think of themselves as endurance athletes. Even milers utilize a tremendous amount of aerobic function. And so I eventually came up with the idea that, hey, this is at the forefront of what I want to do in my human performance approach, which is to maximize aerobic function. And MAF became the thing. And I didn't realize it was the first three letters in my last name until really a year or so later, when somebody said, oh, that's cute. It's like, that's interesting.
Yeah, nice coincidence.
Yeah, so it was a very important thing. It was a very serious thing. And it sort of separates the serious from the unserious athletes. A lot of, if you look at the surveys as to why people join a gym or why they join exercise clubs, the first reason, the main reason they do it is for social reasons. And I was always put off by that. And so when I started to see those surveys, I would always, whenever a new athlete or a new patient would come into my clinic, one of the first things I said is, why are you here? And if they said for social reasons, then I... No, they didn't say that, but sometimes they kind of did indirectly. And I realized that they were not really being serious. They were just jumping from one doctor to another, or they were coming to see me because their insurance covered it, or they were, I don't know. But, it got to the point, especially as I started getting busy, that I really had to be more selective because I wanted to only work with people who were serious about their health and performing better.
Interesting. This idea of fat burning is all the rage now. You are ahead of your time. Fat max, and then there's the zone two, which I guess you need to know. We're talking about a five zone model if we're talking about zone two. But yeah, people are talking about that more and more now. I heard you say one time that it really gave me a chuckle, so I want to get it out here as well. And that was that somebody came to you and said that they were doing anaerobic exercise, and you went, "What? You do it while you hold your breath?"
Yeah, for a long time, for years. And I had fun. It was really hard in the beginning to talk about fat burning and slow training and all these things. So I had to find some comedy along the way. And one of them was the running magazine definition of aerobic and anaerobic. Aerobic is breathing.
Yeah.
And obviously anaerobic is not breathing. So if you're doing anaerobic workouts, do you really hold your breath?
Yeah, exactly.
There was a trend back, I think, when I was in college. It may come and go, I don't know, but where you do sprints, you do full out short sprints, and then you just stop and you hold your breath. Ah. Of course, a lot of people pass out when they do that, but that's, you know, it's no pain, no gain, man. If you pass out, then that you got to do it again.
If it costs you a few brain cells, that's the price you got to pay.
Just a few. We have a lot of extras.
That's funny. Glenn and I used to spend time on the velodrome, and there was an actual sport there where you would do as fast as you could go around the track one time, and it would be, 12 seconds or something. And I assure you, I did a lot of breathing in 12 seconds. As much as I possibly could. So sure. Anaerobic is probably not the right word for that. Anyway, this idea of working on the fat burning, another thing that I've heard you say is that when people were coming to you, and I think you were working with runners maybe mostly at this time, they were getting injured a lot, these guys. They were pushing themselves really hard and on the verge of breaking down all the time. And perhaps related to that, as I look at Mark Allen's name is going to come up here in a little bit. And I was looking at, his performance in the Iron Man, back in the 80s and the 90s. And then I was looking at some of the other guys. And you could see, especially on the other guys, where like they'd win it this year, and then the next year they didn't show up. And then they'd win the next year after that. It's like, well, why was that? They were injured.
Yeah, it's the whatever happened to phenomenon. You look at go back 5 years and look at the sports magazine covers, see who's on those covers. And then you have to think, gee, whatever happened to that person and that person? And it was the trend. It was the way things worked. And trends are funny because they get into your head. And if they're negative, if they're unhealthy, they're still in your head. It's like an earworm. It's like those advertising jingles.
Yeah.
We can't let go of them, and they really are harmful for the brain, as the research shows.
Oh no!
Yeah, it was a tough road for me to convince people to do things that were just absurd sounding and went against all the the conventional wisdom. Early on, the only way I can get somebody's attention is if they were injured. And I was able to help them very quickly. Then they say, oh, gee, he fixed my knee. Nobody else could do that. I wonder what he's saying about this fat stuff and slow. I mean, maybe there's something to that. He fixed my injury. I mean, and so it was sort of, you don't have a reputation. All you're known for is, talking about fat instead of sugar, slow instead of fast. And so you need a little niche somewhere, and that was always helpful.
Yeah. I guess I'll say here that as I've been doing this podcast now for, I guess we're coming up on 3 years, and the more I've studied about this whole business of health and fitness and even now longevity, the more I come to understand that the body and the mind want and need cycles of stress and recovery, of feast and famine, of growth and repair, of intensity and relaxation, and again and again. Is that how you think about it? I mean, well, how do you think about it, Dr. Phil?
Yeah, that's a good way to express it. And that cycle is actually made up of many, many, many cycles. And those cycles go from a minute-long cycle, when you look at circadian rhythms, we we think of 24-hour cycles, but there's a lot of little ones along that 24-hour period. And of course, in sports, when you train, the resting, the recovery phase is much more important than our training, because that's where we get stronger. That's where we get better endurance. Mm. And most athletes who have not run a personal best or performed their best for too many years, the problem is often that they're not recovering based on the amount of work they're doing, or they're doing too much work for the recovery time they have, or some combination of both.
Yeah.
And just thinking logically about your world, your schedule, what you're doing, what you're trying to do, what hasn't happened, what is happening, and piece it together in a more logical way. This stuff is all logical. This is not, it's not hit and miss, and there's no magic formula that everybody can follow or should follow. And most people should be able to train themselves. This should be intuitive, instinctual. We should know what to do. We shouldn't need heart monitors. We should be able to go out for a run and run at a pace and a distance that our brain wants to run on that given day at that particular time. Instead, people are following some formula, some training program, or they're thinking about their competition and thinking all kinds of erroneous things like, oh, my competition's running twice as far today. I should maybe run farther. It's really simple. It's all very, very simple and very physiologically sound.
Yeah. This idea of doing the math method, which people might call FatMax or zone two, that kind of a thing, it seems counterintuitive to people. You talked about how it was challenging to get athletes to do it, because what they want to do is they want to go after, they want to try as hard as they can to accomplish the thing that they want, right? I want a higher FTP. I want to maximize my VO2 max. So just tell me what to train that is going to let me do that. And when you say, well, I need you to do something completely different from that, and that is what is going to get you those things, it's like, wait a minute. This is a matter of faith. I just have to trust you. I hate that.
Yeah, it is a matter of trust. And you know, like I said, in the beginning, it was not easy, because there were so many people and things, articles against what I was doing. And I questioned myself with some regularity, but I was a clinician, and my goal was to help someone be healthy. And if it was an athlete, then by being healthy, doing all the right things, they would also perform better. And
yeah,
that was, you know, that was the big picture. And that was a hard sell as well, because athletes, you know, we think of athletes as being automatically healthy. And of course, that's a mistake. Many of them, most of them literally are injured. Many of them retire at an early age because they're so injured. And an injury is not just a physical breakdown. It's a biochemical breakdown where their metabolism may crash. It may be a mental, emotional breakdown where they just can't get out of bed in the morning. They're depressed.
Right.
It's interesting. And people need to think about all these things and think about your goal. Your goals, if you're an athlete, and we're all athletes, some of us train more than others. Some of us compete and others don't. But if you're an athlete, as all humans are, our goal should be to continue being a better and better athlete as we age. And, you know, we want to be the first one to compete in the 100 to 109 or whatever the category will be then.
Yes.
Because that's the way it should be. I mean, who would have thought there'd be a 70-year-old category, an 80-year-old, 90-year-old category?
Yeah.
Just a few years ago. I mean, when I started out, I did some clinical studies in my clinic. I had a lot of, you were right. I had a lot of runners in the beginning because I worked in the New York City suburbs. That's where my clinic was. And the running boom in the 70s was exploding. And so If you were a cyclist, you were sort of a quiet cyclist. You didn't want anybody to know because you were a cyclist. Wait a minute. Everybody else is a runner. What are you doing riding a bike?
There you go.
And so I saw a lot of runners. And when I first developed my heart rate formulas, it was, if you're in this condition, if these things are happening to you, if those things are happening, you make these adjustments. And I said something about, you know, if you're over 60, it's because I only had one athlete who was 60. So I had no data on 60-year-olds except for this one guy. Yeah. And it took a while, but quickly those numbers piled up and I was able to get the numbers. But, you know, here we are and we're still going strong and we're still seeing these 70, 80s and 90-year-old athletes out there forming their own categories.
Right. The connection back to the business of I want to have a higher FTP and why can't I just train at FTP to make that happen was to come back to talk about recovery, because recovery is, it's one of those things that everybody knows about, but nobody does. And it's because you can't go after it directly. You can't try really hard to recover. You have to do it indirectly.
Right. And it's a good way to put it. You can't try hard. You have to do nothing. And doing nothing in today's athletic world, you're a sissy.
Well, just that our busy lives, who has time to do nothing? I'm going to not do something that maybe would be good for my job or for my house that needs some repairs. And instead, I'm going to do nothing. What are you talking about?
Even in education, we've got to continually learn. We've got to put our nose to the grindstone and abuse ourselves and keep at it. We need to study, study, study. Well, that's a bunch of crap because that's not how it works. That's not how the brain works. Hmm. You give the brain a little bit of something and then leave it alone. Let it figure out what has to happen.
Right.
But also in the same vein, we have a problem where most people don't even sleep enough. They don't sleep enough hours. A normal night's sleep is 7 to 9 hours of uninterrupted sleep. And most people don't get that. So if you're an athlete and you don't even sleep enough, you can't come close to your potential.
Yeah, I dream of being able to sleep as well as my children. I used to be able to when I was their age. I had no recovery issues when I could sleep like the dead. But my busy life intrudes in on my sleep now. And so I'm like all these people who pointing fingers at, I know how important recovery is, and I'm not doing a very good job of it.
So we've got all these things in our body. We've got all these things in our brain, all these things in our body, and we're the conductor of the orchestra. We've got to make everything run. We're in charge, and that doesn't mean we have to put out every little fire and make the motor cortex contract the fibers at the right time, you know, because the brain does it automatically. But we can interfere, and we do way too much. Stress is the word that comes to mind when we look at that. And again, stress is not what people think it is. Stress is physical. If we train too hard, that's an example of a physical stress. If we're wearing shoes that don't fit, it's a physical stress. Stress can be biochemical. If we're eating bad food, it's a biochemical stress. And of course, stress, as people think of, is mental, emotional. And mental, emotional stress includes the understanding of training, the understanding of food, the understanding that, and I wrote a paper on this, a scientific paper, is how do we decide what health factors we should follow? How do we decide what foods to buy, what equipment to buy? And what we've done as a society is we've jumped to the conclusion that I'm going to buy this food because somewhere along the way, I know a guy who's really fast and he eats this food, so I'm going to get it too. Mm-hmm. Or we have the earworms in our brain with the jingle saying, you know, something about Twinkies and you know, they're good for your health, as everyone knows. And so we're duped into doing the wrong things. And those are the attempt at instant karma, the attempt at I'm going to grab this shoe because I heard it's the best, rather than using our brain to think and make a decision based on logic, which is just not happening.
It's hard in any case. And going back to the sleep thing, I have come to feel that one of the big problems with sleep is that it's another one of those things where you just can't try really hard and overcome it when you're having a problem sleeping.
Yeah.
It's like a downward spiral where when you start having trouble sleeping, you start not recovering well, physically and mentally, maybe emotionally, and then that starts to accumulate and starts to impact your sleep. So now you're sleeping even mm-hmm. less well, and you're having more accumulated damage, and you just go worse and worse and worse. How do you break the cycle? Well, you can't go after it by trying harder.
Yeah. Yeah. It becomes a vicious cycle. And that's what a lot of people are caught up in. And
yeah.
My job as a coach, as a clinician, was always to first see the big picture. Let's look at this vicious cycle. What's going on? Okay, we can label all the points along the way and then look at what are the primary things? What are the key features? Can we do one little thing therapeutically or through lifestyle that will fix a whole bunch of things in this cycle and help break it? And that was the game I always played. And in my writing, I often talk about, you know, primary problems and secondary problems and
interesting.
Very, very important features, because we can't just line up our problems and, you know, check them off one at a time, because it doesn't work.
They're connected. Yeah. Now I want to get into music and your book, Be Sharp. But rather than diving deep into the deep end here, let's start with the shallow end, which is just music and exercise. How should a wise athlete use music before exercise, during exercise, after exercise? What do you think?
Well, let me go back to the beginning. The first humans had two very important things that were glued together in the brain, and that's movement and music. Hmm. They still are glued together in the brain. They occur together. You can't do one without the other. And people say, well, I go for a run. I don't think about music. Well, you may not consciously think about it, but most people do. If you really can get away with not thinking about it, your subconscious mind is thinking about it. And we know this from the research.
And so do you mean more than just like prepared music? You mean like rhythms, like my breathing rhythm and my running
all
rhythm?
Yeah. I mean, everything is, you know, the gait movement is quite a rhythm, and it's a changing rhythm. Of course, we've got the heartbeat. We've got the breathing mechanism. It's that orchestra I mentioned early. There's this big orchestra, our brain and body, that are doing different things. Every instrument is doing something different and something very, very important. Mm-hmm. And we can't start thinking about, you know, we don't do it now. We don't think about our breathing unless we're running up a hill and we're getting out of breath in an easy training run. That's, you know, we get annoyed now. We're thinking, gee, why am I so tired? We don't think about how to put one foot in front of the other. At least we shouldn't. There's so many things. If you just take one step, there are millions of things going on between the brain and body, back and forth. The brain sends messages to the body to bring the foot forward. And then everything along the way, the ligaments, the tendons, the joints, all the muscle fibers, they in turn send messages back to the brain to tell it what's going on. The brain then analyzes it, sends more messages back to tweak the activity. This all happens in a moment's time and continually along the way. And so if we think we can intervene consciously in that, we're delusional. We can't. When we have a better brain, we do that better. than when we don't have a better brain. So the music and the movement being tied together is, number one, potentially a valuable thing we can influence by listening to good music, which we can talk about the definition of that. And the other component of that is are there people, just like all other aspects of our lifestyle, shoe companies, food companies, are there musical things? Is there music out there that is actually making our brain less healthy and therefore our movement not as good as it could be? And the answer is yes. There's a lot of fake music out there. Just like junk food, there's junk music. You know, I was a huge consumer of music, and I studied many things, among them Chinese medicine, and I learned about music therapy from Chinese medicine as a student. So this was not new to me, but it wasn't until, as one chapter of my book is titled, it was 20 years ago today that I woke up as a songwriter. I struggled with trying to learn music, trying to play music, and suddenly I wake up and now I am a songwriter. And I kind of, you know, I studied a lot of biology and I knew what Darwin wrote about music in the human brain and how music was such a powerful influence in bringing us to the point we're at today as human beings. And one thing that I was missing out on was being a songwriter. And so it was such a powerful thing, was such an incredible passion that I really quit my job, ran off to LA, and I was now a songwriter, and this is what I'm going to do. And here we are.
Yeah. And you did it. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Well, so where I was trying to go with this question of using music with exercise was down this path that where I first went down when I first heard you talk about using music to relax, I realized that I only ever listened to fast tempo music anymore. That's all I ever listened to. And that was my choice because, well, that charged me up. That got me revved up. And then it was great to go work out. You know, and it made the exercise feel easier. I mean, it was just like something that made my life better. But I realized, you know, I'd get done with my workout and I'd still be listening to my charged up music that was keeping my heart rate up and making me feel like I'm ready to do something else now, instead of what I needed to be doing, which was recovering from my exercise.
There's that key word again, recovery. And to kind of tie that together with what you asked earlier, which I didn't get a chance to answer, which is what kind of music. One of the things about recovery that's really, really important is that what recovery does is it balances the autonomic nervous system.
Yeah.
And if you've studied heart rate variability, you know what the nervous system, what the autonomic nervous system is. It's the balance of sympathetic and parasympathetic. And when we go for a workout, we are stimulating the sympathetic system. And when we get done, especially when we sleep at night, we're turning on the parasympathetic and winding down the sympathetic. And that's a great part of what recovery is all about. And music clearly impacts that in a significant way. And so before we go for a workout, we really want to go into it being a little bit relaxed. We don't want to rev ourselves up because first thing we want to do in a workout is to warm up. That's a slow, easy buildup to the level of intensity that we're going to maintain for the bulk of the run. And then after the workout, we want to recover. And that means we want to rebalance our autonomic nervous system with some more easy, relaxing music. The hard part for people is my recommendation, which I've always had way before I became a songwriter. My recommendation was always not to listen to music during exercise. And what I said was that I'd rather you listen to your body, because there's a lot of really good information there. And if you're listening to music, you're not listening to your body. And so you're missing out on an opportunity to learn about your gait or your breathing or your whatever. And of course, the first thing people say is, well, there are studies that show that exercise and music go together and the music helps us with our exercise. Well, that's not what the studies show. The studies show that music helps drive our exercise. It helps get us out of bed, you know, knowing that we're going to have this raging music in our ears. It helps us get out the door. When we go to the gym, we're tired from yesterday's workout, but now here's this pounding music and we're going to jump on the treadmill and we're going to get through. And the research also shows that exercise will help us cope with the pain of exercise. We got to cope with the pain of exercise. Okay. Competition is painful because you're trying to push yourself beyond max. And that is painful. But day in and day out, pain means something's wrong. And so this whole idea, this hype about exercise music and the reason gyms play music is all marketing by the music industry. It's the same reason why they have music in stores. When you go in a store, there's music because it helps people buy more. To keep it short, and I go into this in the book a lot more, but the short answer is don't listen to music while you're working out. Listen to your body and listen to easy music before and easy music after. It'll help you relax and recover better.
What I have found for myself, now that I have been following this advice, it not only is helping me to relax instead of charging right into the next stressful thing. Maybe I'm not going to go do more exercise, but I'm going to jump right into some work thing, or I'm going to do something else that's going to be stressful and not going to let my sympathetic come down and my parasympathetic come up. If I can do it without being embarrassed, right? If I can get into my car and I'm by myself essentially, and I can sing to the music, I feel happy. I'm not just recovering, I'm happy. Instead of just on to my busyness in my life and doing things that are important and I have to do, I'm happy. Well, that is worth the price of admission.
It is, and you've discovered something that really works for you, and it's a common thing that works for people because singing is our first language. That's how humans made music in the beginning. We sang, and it was music we sang to each other. We selected the best mate. We told our enemies that we're here and we're protecting the family, so keep away. And, you know, it took millions of years to develop verbal language, a written language. But we had music all along, and it's the same music that you hear in the animals every day, the birds, every animal makes music. And singing is particularly powerful. And in the book, I talk about, and I won't bore you with fMRI studies, but they've seen all these things in the brain now. Mm-hmm. We can greatly benefit by listening to music. We can greatly benefit by listening to the music we love. We all have oldies.
Yeah.
So listening to an oldie is really, really powerful. But also listening to a song we've never heard before is an amazing thing because it's a surprise for the brain. And one of the things that the brain loves even more than listening to oldies is a surprise. And a song we never heard before, whether we like it or not, is a surprise. And what it does is it gets the neurons in the brain making connections that never were made before. Mm-hmm. That's an aha moment. And so listening to new music is a wonderful thing as well. But now if we take a further step and sing, now we play music. Singing is playing music because we have an instrument called the voice. If we play music, that ramps us up to a whole nother level of brain benefits. And if we play an instrument, a piano or a guitar, and sing at the same time, wow, that's more bonus work that we get to benefit from. And interestingly enough, if we see someone at a show playing music, we get maximum benefits. That's why music videos are so powerful and so successful since MTV launched that whole world. Because now we not only hear the song, but we see it being performed, and more parts of our brain are enlisted in that process, and we get even more benefits.
Yeah. Okay, and then the second thing I wanted to bring up is just something I've heard come up in earlier talks of yours, and this relates to the negative effect of having hard-charging music that you love that revs you up while you're exercising is this. In the MAF method, what you're trying to do is get people to be stronger, to be faster, to put more power out at the same heart rate. So over time, they get stronger without having to raise their heart rate. This is how they become stronger at a higher heart rate too.
Right.
But the point is that when they're out exercising most of the time, they're not trying to raise their heart rate. They're trying to get stronger at the same heart rate. But when they're listening to music that revs them up, their heart rate goes up. And so it's interfering with this training. Is that right?
It is. That's exactly right. And that's one of the studies, or some of the studies, that show how music supposedly helps exercise, in that it raises the heart rate. And there's that old-fashioned myth that's still out there, which is when we exercise, the game is burning more calories. Everything goes back to this whole weight loss thing, and it's really not weight, it's fat. And it's really not calories, it's fat calories. When somebody says, well, I'm going to burn more calories, just ask them what kind of calories they're burning. And they'll either walk away from you or run away from you, or they will look very confused. Like, aren't calories calories? Well, we, as humans, we burn sugar calories, we burn fat calories. You know, for the first 10 seconds, we burn creatinine phosphate, but we primarily burn fat and sugar. If we burn a lot of sugar, we're not burning a lot of fat, and therefore it stays in storage, or we keep storing the calories that we've consumed because there's nowhere for them to go. So, raising the heart rate is, you know, it's part of that whole macho no pain, no gain thing, which has been with us, from the days of Benjamin Franklin. And it's been borrowed by every group, eventually it was borrowed by sports. And we all learned it from our gym teachers, you know, no pain, no gain.
Right.
And it's a really sad thing, because that's the way to begin an overtraining syndrome, where people start getting injured, their performance goes down, and it's a tough situation.
Yeah. Now let's transition. We're still talking about music, but let's transition into the bigger topic. I think that you've characterized it as music and aging well, and music and improving the brain. And as a part of this transition, I want to read part of a quote that from Mark Allen that he wrote about your book. And so for people listening here who aren't quite sure who Mark Allen was, he won the Hawaii Ironman 6 times from 89 to 95. And he was a very good athlete. Tell me if I'm saying this wrong, Dr. Phil. He was a very good athlete, like a top 10, maybe even a podium finisher before you started working with him. But he was not winning. And by following your training, he became perhaps the greatest of all time endurance athlete. Is that approximately right, at least?
Yeah, I think Mark would say that. But I think, you know, the credit goes to Mark for being willing to take a chance on some crazy, because now we're talking about 1983, yeah. when the no pain, no gain world in sports was still the thing.
Yeah.
But the one thing about Mark is that he's really, really disciplined. And he's very intelligent. So he used his intelligence, he used his discipline to try this crazy thing because he was getting injured a lot and he couldn't catch these guys in front of him usually. And so, you know, the discipline of using the program is really what helped him. And I would say the discipline of the program, when people say, yeah, I tried Maffetone stuff and it didn't help me. Well, the problem is, number one, you either didn't do it right or you weren't disciplined.
Or you didn't do it long enough.
Which is the discipline. And so that's something that Mark had, and I recognized that in the beginning, and I didn't have to spend a lot of time convincing him to take care of himself or to train better. He already got it.
Well, good. Well, and I'm going to give him credit for saying something very interesting, and that's going to help us to talk about this next part of this last part of our conversation. He wrote more, so I'm taking just a bit of it. He says, reducing stress, gaining happiness, experiencing joy and fulfillment, living a life filled with longevity and vitality. In B Sharp, that's your book, Dr. Maffetone explains how participation in music brings us all of this and more. Okay. He is obviously talking about more than recovering from exercise. Do you want to talk about this a little bit? I mean, how can we get all of those things? Because I'd like some.
It's the big picture. You know, we don't live in a world that's made up of all these compartments. We need to look at the big picture. We need to be the conductor of our orchestra. And joy and happiness and peace and love, it's all there that for some reason eludes too many people. And going that way, experiencing that, and in the book I talk about a number of exercises, mental exercises that people can do, ways of listening, a 5-minute power break where you get your brain into a deep meditation that often takes people an hour, but you can do it in 5 minutes. And what an incredible recovery thing to do. And so it kind of teaches, how could I get to what Mark is talking about? It's the big picture. And we have this, like you said, more than once, is you know, there's too much going on in life, and our day is going from one thing to another. And no wonder we can't sleep, because our brain is still going when we get into bed, and we're our stress hormone is still high, as if we're in the middle of our workday.
Yeah. This business of music being something fundamental, I'll admit, has not occurred to me until I've been listening to you talk about it. And actually, now that I am hearing you talk more and more about it, it's like, well, duh, of course. Who hasn't, like, listened to Christmas music and they're, like, immediately brought back to Christmas with their family when they were young and it's, you know, happy times? Or maybe perhaps to our detriment, we've been listening to exercise music, which has revved us up. Well, that's the music. We all know that music has a powerful effect. There's some backdoor programming to our brain that music has access to. And maybe it's not the back door, maybe it's the front door. Maybe all this other stuff we think is so important is the back door.
It sure is the front door, because it's front and center. It's you know, there's no one who's not got music in their head, with some exceptions of serious brain injuries. But Big Brother knows about it because we are bombarded by marketing all the time with music, the goal of which is for you to buy something or do something, enlist something in your life that is not healthy and illogical, but you're going to do it anyway because the message was carried on a piece of music and it gets in your brain and
gets past your defenses.
all I have to do is mention a few names, which I'm not going to do, of products. And you will not only think about them, but you will think about the related music of a TV or a radio commercial or something. And
and
it's really sad that we've got all that junk in our brain still. And literally, if we listen to good, healthy music that we like, we literally can kick out some of that bad stuff.
Everybody knows this already. I think that the idea, what you're bringing to the forefront, is that we can use it as a tool ourselves. We can find the music that we love to use to as levers to change our mental states, because the songs carry a program with them that somehow gets past all of our defenses through all of our filters, and we feel a certain way when we hear a certain song. And I guess that can be, I know for a fact that that can be engineered, because my exercise playlist has been fast-paced songs, but it's a curated list, and it's a list that I've listened to 1,000 times as I have exercised over the last 20 years. And when I hear those songs, I'm on. My heart rate is going. It doesn't matter how tired I am ready to go. Also, like songs from my childhood, songs that I liked when I was a kid, but I don't hear them very often, I travel back through time immediately, and I feel like I did as a kid.
Yes, and you know, they've actually measured physiological age of people being younger when they listen to those kinds of songs from when they were.
So it's more than a mental state. Your whole body changes.
It's a physiological change, exactly.
And that's amazing.
And a biochemical change as well. And you probably by now, everybody has seen the images and the videos of, you know, some guy in a nursing home with Alzheimer's who can't see anyone, talk to anyone, or really just stares ahead. Suddenly he gets some earphones and he hears a song from when he was 18 years of age, and he suddenly wakes up and starts talking.
Yeah.
This is old stuff. I mean, we've been doing that for years. When people see it, they can't help but shed a tear, because that's how powerful music is. And imagine if we don't have Alzheimer's and everything is, we think, working really well, how much better are we going to work with the music? Well, I could tell you, in my case, when I became a songwriter, I became a better writer of articles and books. I became a better speaker. I became a better person in many, many ways. And I was as shocked as anyone, because it wasn't expected. I was, you know, now I'm a songwriter. Okay, so you write words and you learn to play the guitar and the piano. And I didn't know it was going to, because I was already into music. I was always powerfully listening to music from, you know, the middle of high school or earlier. And I thought I got all the musical benefits. Well, suddenly those benefits tripled and quadrupled and went even beyond that. You know, and you know, physical health, mental, emotional health, biochemical health, just indescribable, although I tried to describe it in the book.
Yes. And thank you for doing that. It feels like this feels, I never imagined, Dr. Phil, that I was ever going to have a podcast about music on the Wise Athletes. I mean, how could it possibly be relevant, you know, to Wise Athletes? But, you know, as I've been preparing for this and here talking with you, it feels to me like this is maybe in the same category of importance as nutrition or exercise, that this is, this path to music,
it sure
can
is.
Do a lot.
It can. And it's sad to see that music and the arts in general have been taking more and more of a backseat in our society, especially over the last couple of hundred years, but especially within our generation, because there's so much more coming up front, taking its place, especially in the world of marketing and advertising.
All right, Dr. Phil. Okay, so we're going to wrap up here. I wanted to do two things as a part of the wrap up. One would be just to open the door for you to say, tell us anything else that we ought to know. I mean, obviously we can get your book and learn all that is in there and listen to this podcast again and other podcasts that you have talked about this. But what would you say that we haven't talked about, or maybe that we have and you want to emphasize? What would be the last thing you would want to say about this? And then tell us how we can find out more about you and your music.
Well, one thing I would say is that if whether you're an athlete or a teacher, parent, whoever you are as a human being, if things are not working as well as you'd like, if you're not competing as well, if you're injured, if you're not feeling good, if you feel like you're older than your age, whatever, it means something is wrong. And one of your jobs, I don't want to tell you what your job is, but one of the things that as humans, we have this intelligence, one of the things we're really meant to do is to figure out if something is wrong, what's wrong and how to fix it. And as you say, music is one of the upfront and personal things for humans and has been from the beginning. So pay attention to that. People can find out more about me from my music website, which is maffetonemusic.com. And the book is, I don't know where it is, everywhere out there. But if you go on Amazon and search Be Sharp is an interesting title. B refers to the musical note. And people who know music, sometimes they stop in their tracks and they think, Be sharp. Oh, be sharp. Oh, yes, be sharp. Oh, it's actually a C in music. That's how bad music is from an academic standpoint.
That is confusing.
It is. But be sharp also refers obviously to the brain and becoming a more intellectual, emotionally, mentally strong individual.
Yes. Well, fantastic. I'll get the links to all of that in the show notes for people who didn't take notes. And Dr. Phil, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and everybody listening in, you can't tell, but Glenn has been with us all along, and he's got technical problems, so he's just grinning at you right now. But he's thinking of you, even though he can't say anything.
Thanks, Glenn.
All right, guys, you have a great night.
Thank you so much for listening in to our chat with Dr. Phil Maffetone. You can find more information about Dr. Phil and his music in the show notes, and you can hear the entire song, Twice in One Lifetime, starting in just a few seconds. You won't be disappointed.
Hanging up the phone, I lay down to cry. I thought about this roller coaster. Best thing we can do is just say goodbye. I feel the feeling falling deep inside. She did it to me twice in one lifetime. Too much for one heart. Twice in one lifetime. Me a sign. I thought about a dream I did not have. I lied. Best thing for me is to go to bed and die and feel the feeling falling deep inside. She did it to me twice in one lifetime. Look the ball. about this roller coaster ride. Best thing we can do is just say goodbye and feel the feeling falling deep inside. She did it to me twice.